Welcome, everybody, to the Dockyard Elixir Roundtable. Today, we are very happy to have Chris Granger with us. Chris is the CTO of Amplified, and today we want to talk about businesses that are adopting Elixir, what went into their decision-making process, and what success, hopefully, if any, that they've seen from that. Chris, I first wanted to introduce you. I think I saw your name around a bit over the over a period of time, but I really became more aware of you through the machine learning channel in the EEF, and that seems to be where a lot of your focus time's been spent with Elixir. Can you tell us a bit more about your own personal history, your journey towards Elixir adoption, and of course, sharing Amplified's story?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Brian. I'm happy to be here. And definitely spending a lot of time in the EEF machine learning chat. So my background actually is in academia. Before I started a company, I was working as an economist. I was trying to understand the way that climate policy can affect the rate and direction of innovation. And I was using a lot of patent data to do that. I met a friend of a friend who was working in kind of patent consulting and sales and things like that. And he had some ideas for how machine learning could help change the way that patent work was being done. And we kind of talked and had a few conversations over a period of time and eventually started a company. A lot of the work that I was doing, trying to integrate the patent data into econometric models, was also useful for going and doing things like patent searching and understanding patent portfolios and things like that. So we formed a company in 2017, and we've been kind of moving on from there.
So did you have prior programming experience?
I did, mostly in R and in Python. I was doing a little bit of Scala here and there as well, but it was primarily for econometrics. So I was doing a lot of statistical models. But the first thing I really used in Anger was R, and then moved on to Python from there to start doing a little bit, work with larger data sets and doing some more, real machine learning, as it were.
So where, at what point did you find out about Elixir? What drew you into it and what made you pull the trigger on saying we should go with this?
So I actually did a bit of language hopping. So I think as a first time CTO and building a web application for the first time, our startup is based around a SaaS app that goes around the machine learning work that we're doing. I think the one thing I knew is that I definitely didn't want to do it in R, just not something that was possible. Yeah. And I really
is there an R based web framework yet? Like, there's a web framework for almost
there's some
every
API
language,
stuff.
Right? Oh, there is.
Yeah, there's some API stuff. It's like, I think one called PlumR. But not really a web framework.
That's actually a good name. I like that name.
Yeah, me too. I appreciate all the kind of like R puns and things that they get going. Mm. So I tried out a bunch of different things. The obvious thing would have been to go with Python, but when I originally started trying to build some prototypes in Flask, it didn't jive with me. I really struggled to get something from ideation to something that I could put in front of customers that I was happy with. And I tried to play with, with Django, and I found it really overwhelming. There's a ton of magic. It was again, very difficult to get to, for that 0 to 1 moment was really challenging. Mm-hmm. We actually had a little while where we used Ruby, and the very first MVP that we had was in Rails. And again, that was okay. But I had the problem of, okay, I'm trying to work with machine learning things in Python while also trying to kind of personally learn Ruby and develop this application in Rails. And again, I really struggled with the magic side of things. I found it really confusing and really challenging as a kind of a first time CTO founder trying to produce something. I wanted to look behind the scenes a little bit more. I wanted to be able to have more control over what was happening, particularly with the data side of things. The kind of ORM approach was a challenge in both Django and in Rails.
Do you find that your data scientific background lends itself more towards like mental mapping, just functional programming directly, as opposed to like object-oriented programming, inheritance, all the implicit
Absolutely.
magic code that goes into a lot of the other frameworks?
Yeah, definitely. I think that plays a role. I think the idea of thinking about data moving through transformation pipelines and things like that, it's a functional concept to me. And also, I think I'm influenced by the fact that I did cut my teeth with R. R is all sorts of things. It's a kind of Frankenstein of a language, but I think the best parts of R are definitely functional. There's the whole tidyverse and all of that. And it just felt much more natural to me, that kind of approach to data.
I'm curious your take on this then. Like, I know historically why Python became the de facto language in academia. It's largely influenced by MIT's decision to move its curriculum over to Python away from Lisp. And a lot of other universities just say, oh, MIT is doing that. We should do that. And kind of, I mean, that's one reason why. But why hasn't a functional programming language really kind of, if in that space it maps really well to what they're learning, let's say on the chalkboard or elsewhere, why has a object-oriented language been so dominant and a functional one hasn't taken over in academia yet?
I think that's a good question. When it comes to data processing pipelines and things like that, a lot of the really powerful stuff, the really I guess high performance stuff is actually in languages that have mutable data structures. So you see a whole bunch of the very high performance stuff that's being written in C++ and now starting to move into Rust and things like that. So I think that there was a little bit of a natural belief that, oh, you need to have mutability despite the fact we're working in a high level language at this point. And there's an ecosystem aspect, I think, as well.
So
But
we get all sorts of listeners. I want to just provide a little bit more detail for some of our listeners. In the olden days, we had to choose how values were sent between functions, and we had to choose whether they were sent by reference or by copy. And so, for performance reason and for memory constraint reasons, object-oriented languages kind of took off over more of the pure like functional languages at one point because memory was limited on the machine, and having to do constant memory copying is an expensive operation, which had performance penalties. Nowadays, of course, we don't feel that nearly as much, but when it's going to come still to certain like highly optimized environments, you're always going to win by using mutation over copy by value.
absolutely, definitely. A lot of, I would say most functional programming languages will have immutable data structures. And that's always been seen to be a bit of a challenge, as you said. It's we end up every mutation that we make, we're using up more and more memory, and we have to follow that chain. I think there's an element of there's the fact that functional languages are still kind of a minority overall. That's what people are comfortable with. As you said, the move from Scheme and Lisp to Python meant the whole generation of new computer scientists were learning with this kind of high level object oriented primarily language. Yeah, I think it's that ecosystem aspect that comes into play there. It's you just the fact that there are so many people using Python these days means that anything that you want to reach for, you can go and grab it. So it creates a network effect. It's
Yeah,
it
it
creates something
snowballs
that
at
builds
some
on
point
itself.
where like
Exactly.
yeah, all the groundwork was laid, all the kind of like primitive and maybe even like tier two tooling has been built out, and now those that are getting into it are not really interested in creating that low level primitive stuff. They want to do things with it.
That's exactly right. And I mean, you can look at Torch and what became PyTorch. Torch was originally written in Lua, of all things, and then ended up moving over into PyTorch. And so PyTorch, Python was for the purposes that they had, it was a massive improvement. There, you had this whole ecosystem that existed in Python that, Lua, for all of its benefits and the ability to embed it and all these other wonderful things that it has, it didn't have anywhere near the ecosystem that Python has. So being able to work on the research side of machine learning in an environment where you can again pull things off the shelf for the things that aren't mission critical, it provides massive benefits.
Okay, so bringing things back to your story, you researched several different, or in your own definition, language hopped between several different languages and frameworks. Where did the V1 of Amplified land? Which tech
Oh, it depends on what we count as V1.
stack?
V0, I think I already mentioned,
V0.
we had done in Rails, and that very rapidly was replaced by we ended up then doing a Phoenix backend and a React front end, partly because we had a lot of interactivity that needed to happen. Our app fits the idea of an SPA pretty well. It's a very kind of interactive application. There's a lot of client side stuff going on, and so we ended up we ended up using Phoenix for the back end and React for the front end.
So Phoenix as an API was essentially your gateway drug to Elixir.
And that is exactly right. Yes. We were, it was partly because I was attracted to GraphQL, and Absinthe was being touted as being, actually one of the best kind of libraries for GraphQL. And I started reading a little bit more about Elixir and played with it a little bit, and I just really liked the way that it felt. It kind of spoke to my desire not to have magic in my framework, and not to be working with an ORM, to be a little bit closer to the data itself. Ecto is kind of something different. It's not an ORM, right? And
DSL.
I re yeah exactly I love that. It really spoke to me. I was able to kind of build things out the way that I wanted to and see what was happening behind the scenes if I wanted to pull back the curtain. And that was just a joy.
That's always been, I think, one of my favorite things in Elixir that is really difficult to articulate to those outside of it. Like, for example, you spoke about how Amplified lends itself towards being an SPA. Our kind of tech that we specialized in for a period of time was Ember.js. And so when it came, like building out an application was always fairly rudimentary, like the good architecture. But once you kind of like try to draw outside the lines, and this isn't an Ember thing, I mean, this is just like a JavaScript thing. I mean, dealing with trying to do code spelunking in JavaScript being a prototype language, or even going back to Ruby because of the mutability issue, I always felt like was majority of where I ended up burning my time. I know some like really impressive engineers over my lifetime and gotten to work with some of them where they just have like this, like, boom, remember it. They'll know exactly which line of code, which file everything is in. I don't work that way. Like if I'm not actively working on it and I've stepped away for 5 minutes, I'll forget everything again. And so just how kind of clear and simple and clean a functional programming language was really spoke to me in saying, okay, this has been my biggest like impediment on code delivery, and this solves this problem for me. I don't have to worry about it anymore. But it's not really one that you can go in and say, hey, your company should adopt Elixir, because I mean it's difficult to quantify that, and it feels like a very developer ergonomics thing. So from your perspective as CTO, were you just kind of in a position, and was the product early enough where you felt comfortable making these audible calls to switch over? Or was there a bit of politics involved, some justification on everything that you had to sell your partners on?
I would say that there was a bit of both. The what I started to see was just slowness. I started to see that cruft kind of build up and those challenges build up. What you said about, you know, forgetting where you were 5 minutes later, I feel that all the time. And I felt like I could see my team feeling that. You know, it was a small team, and we were trying to work across this kind of set of silos, where I wanted to hire generalists, and I did for the most part, but there was still this kind of JavaScript Elixir split going on. And what I saw build up is the ability to go from end to end with a feature stopped when it wasn't no longer just me doing it. Right. When I started to grow this team and I started to try to get all of these people working together, that speed going from, you know, zero to one on a feature kind of disappeared. And in fact, it disappeared for me too, because my time started being spent managing and, you know, getting back a little bit more to the data science and data engineering side of things. And so I'd say that was
I was to say, one area that I found to like really benefit from this as well are code reviews. You know, not having context on a pull request sometimes, and you're having to do a code review of an imperative or OOP language, that can be a huge ask, unless you're intimately Absolutely. Familiar with the code base. And, you know, functional programming, I'm just looking at data in, data out.
Yeah. No, I think that's exactly right. I think it was a lot clearer to see what was going on the Elixir side of things. One thing I did see with code reviews is that a team that normally got along really well, sometimes those code reviews would even get a bit combative because you started to see some breaking off, you know, of the people who are mostly working on the front end features are getting frustrated with the inability to get the data that they need from the back end, or having, you know, the API design in the way that they would like it. And, mm-hmm. you know, the people on the back end are arguing of, it needs to be organized this way because the data is coming through this way and we can present it this way. So there was a bit of bickering that was happening. So to come back to your original question about, you know, was it just being able to make those audible calls? I think I could observe the slowdown happening and start to see fragmentation and kind of, yeah, breaking apart of the team. Mm-hmm. That it was, you know, still a young team, but just starting to see it kind of break apart and silo.
And when you made the call to say, like, well, how did that go? Was it kind of a gradual, like, we're going to test something on Elixir and see how it goes? Or did you just come in one day and say, we're doing this?
So I think, if I could fast forward a little bit to sure. the choice to go with LiveView and actually split away from, break away from this split that had developed. That really was coming in one day and saying, we're doing this. I'm constantly in contact with my co-founders, and we're making these decisions all the time. But that was this kind of classic story of, I literally went into my room over the weekend because we were trying to build a new version of our application, basically, which never do that, never go rebuild everything from scratch. But we really needed to, because things had changed so much and we were really had like changed the product, entirely. It was really slow to get off the ground. We were really having trouble. And I just went into my room and built one of the main pages in LiveView. And it was magic. I did it on a Saturday, and I came in on Monday and said, "All right, this is what we're doing. We're making this change. It has to happen."
As much as like single page application frameworks, I think bring a better experience to consuming web applications. Like, I always had this, unfortunately, tongue in cheek perspective on it, because my history, my real first kind of, well, I worked in R&D lab for period of time. But after that, when I got out to do like web application development, it was coming up with Rails. Like I adopted Rails pre 1.0. And the nice thing back then was the competitive landscape was like just, you know, Java, Spring, and then PHP and maybe CGI, if you really are sadomasochistic. So the cost and time to build out complex web applications for that date, like, got completely streamlined by orders of magnitude with Rails. And so the kind of like feeling is that you could build out the same thing for half the time and half the cost with Rails. And that was a no-brainer for people. And along came all the like JavaScript front end frameworks. And despite us being an Ember shop, I would joke around and say, oh, we can build that out for twice the time and twice the money. And that's really how like doing front end application JavaScript development felt. And then Chris built LiveView. And I feel like that's brought things back in that other direction again, where, I mean, there's clearly some use cases that LiveView isn't appropriate for on the client, but for 95% of what you're going to be typically doing, it leads to significant time savings, which translate directly back to cost.
Absolutely. There's no question about that. I'd say, you know, our application lends itself very well to being an SPA. It lends itself a lot better to being a LiveView app. And I think that any time when you're working heavily with data and you need to get that data in front of a customer and have them interact with it in some way, the ability to just completely cut out the middleman to work with contexts, you know, and views rather than designing an entire API surface and then working in an entirely other different language and going fetching the data and doing all of these different things. I mean, we were building features, you know, left, right, and center where before we were struggling to even just get off the ground.
So what year was this now when you switched over to LiveView?
So this was early. This was 2020. And we actually brought on Dashbit to help us with the transition.
Okay. So, you know, there was another company that you could have brought on too. Just joking. So around then is when Jose and Sean first started collaborating on what would eventually become NX. So you already had a Phoenix backend, and presumably all the machine learning aspect was just punting to a Python stack at that point, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So where along the lifecycle of NX did you get ahead of it and say like, oh, they're doing this like day one, I'm going to be involved? Or did it reach a point of maturity where you're like, okay, this is something that we can seriously take a look at?
So I will say that I was kind of already on the lookout for any project that was doing something interesting in this space. I've always felt like Python, not necessarily because it's Python, but just what had built up in terms of the ecosystem had a lot of rough edges. It was really, really frustrating in a lot of ways. And so I was kind of keeping an eye out, and I had seen, you know, there was HaskTorch with Haskell and a bunch of other things that had come up, and nothing was quite hitting the mark. And then lo and behold, all of a sudden I see this thing come out, and I just got very, very excited when it first was announced. But I was also apprehensive. I wanted to keep an eye on it. And so I didn't immediately decide we're definitely going to do this, because, you know, I had way too much on the line. I had already also used some of my capital, and I had been keeping an eye out for alternatives to the Python stack that I was using. I had found it kind of frustrating in a number of different ways. We can get into those a little bit later. You know, I've seen things like HaskTorch, and R had implemented bindings to the Torch C library, the C++ library. So I saw NX was announced, and it was exciting, definitely. I had hopes, but I definitely wasn't ready to bet the company on it from day one. I was a bit apprehensive and wanted to see how it played out. I did want to be involved. So I immediately, you know, jumped onto the mailing list and was like, hey, you need to do data frames and a few other things. I definitely wasn't something that we were ready to adopt immediately. I wanted to see how it evolved and came into being.
So at what point what milestone did NX reach where you felt comfortable that this was something that you could bring into your company?
So the big turning point for me was Sean producing Axon Onyx, Axon ONNX, and the ability to import Onyx runtime models into Axon. Basically, what it meant was that the model that, you know, this kind of big bespoke model that we were using at Amplified, I was able to convert it from PyTorch into ONNX and then import that into Axon, an Axon representation in like, I don't know, like 4 or 5 lines of code. And going from that to seeing the first vector produced, so the first bit of inference where I took a big patent and just ran it through that Axon model and saw that I got the same exact vector, and that was the magic moment. I just immediately said, okay, no, we can do this. It's possible. At the very least, we just keep using this same model. We can just do exactly this. This solves the problem for us. I was ready to go.
And how long did it take to migrate your? Well, I guess I should first ask, are you completely off of Python at this point?
Yes, we are. Yeah.
And how long did that process take?
I think it was a total of from day one to, just completely not having any Python in the stack, it was around 6 months.
Okay.
Now, I would
Was
say
that
that
due to features not being in NX yet that still need to be created?
no, I actually it was in large part due to the complexity of what we had built in Python. There was a coupling that happened with our transition. So it wasn't just transitioning the model into serving it in Elixir. It was also our entire ETL pipeline, and this is so where we had to kind of change a running system without breaking it, kind of for our customers. And doing that proved to be a little bit more time consuming than I had expected. And I'll add that there were some personal things going on. I had moved from Australia to the Netherlands and had a bunch of family stuff going on at the time, so that definitely slowed things down because I was the prime mover on this. So I wouldn't count it as 6 months as head down time making the transition.
Were you the only one writing the code for the transition, or were members of your team on that project as well?
It was mostly me. Yeah, it was mostly me.
Okay. And how would you say the transition turned out? Like, what is it more of a lateral movement in terms of performance and code maintainability, or are there clear benefits that you've seen come about?
I mean, it's night and day benefits. So, I mean, to get into some of them, we slashed our monthly AWS spend in half. And I can talk a little bit about why in a moment, but that was a massive change. And that was one of the kind of real drivers here as well, is that this what we had built in terms of in our ETL had become this kind of like Rube Goldberg machine of like orchestration and Spark and all of this stuff, and simplifying it was massive. In terms of maintainability, we're actually all able to work on the same thing now. So before, I had this weird kind of inversion of resources, right? Where our core value is coming from data science and data engineering, and that's what we're providing for our customers. But most of the resources that we had were built around, or were focused on building the application. So it was me and one other data engineer who were working in Python and doing the ETL work, doing the machine learning work. And what ended up happening was that all the people who are working on Elixir are just see it as a black box. They saw the machine learning and the data engineering in much the same way that some of the front end folks were seeing the back end before. It was just, okay, can you just provide me with the thing that I need? They had no idea what was going on. And if I, was sick, or heaven forbid, hit by a bus or whatever, nobody would have been able to do anything. And they would have had no idea what was going on. So that was absolutely massive. And being able to bring that into the code base that we were working on meant that the maintainability was just, it just skyrocketed. It meant that we're not trying to remember and keep across two completely different ecosystems. We're not trying to build a code base and have, you know, we interact with our Elasticsearch cluster with Python over here and with Elixir over here. We interact with our application database with Python over here and Elixir over here. S3, we just duplicate all of these different things, all these different services that you're using. You know, it was duplicated, and it meant that more often than not, the Python code was what was getting what ended up being stale and what was being ignored. And now that we're doing everything in Elixir, we're all working on everything. We can share the utilities, all the little helpers, all the knowledge that we've accumulated. We can share that across everything that we're doing.
So I think you spoke directly towards dispelling two myths that I think are far too pervasive in modern company building from tech stack side. Like my experience in this space has been that coming up in the 2000s, these were true, and they were that number one, it's cheaper to throw hardware at problems than people, meaning, you know, just scale up by throwing more machines at the problem. And then number two, right tool for the right job, which led to these highly bifurcated companies with multiple tech teams that were just nightmares for overhead and management. So speaking to the first one first, you said you slashed your AWS prices in half. I mean, what is your perspective on that now that it seems hardware costs, especially cloud hardware costs, have gone up dramatically in the past few years? Just spinning up a server is, I feel like, not a good use of money anymore. My perspective is that you want to solve it this at the software level more times than not.
Yeah, definitely. So part of it is just, you know, what the kind of happy path and what what a language or an ecosystem encourages you to do. So in Python, you know, we were using Prefect as a workflow orchestrator, and we were using Spark to work with effectively giant tables. We were doing a lot of work where we would do some work and then save it to S3, and then do some work and then save it to S3, and we building, you know, each time we did that, we had to spin up a cluster, and there's the overhead of actually like spinning up the cluster, moving the data, all of these different things. Whereas in Elixir, you know, we have Broadway, and I was able to use concurrent data processing pipelines, and it was it means that I'm using one machine or two machines to do the work, where I would previously spin up a, you know, a 40 machine cluster and then spin it back down, and then spin up a 20 machine cluster and spin it back down.
Yeah.
It's massive.
Like there's such a culture of waste I've found in the startup space at times that, you know, there's so much accounting that goes into tracking burn rate, but when it comes to sometimes the tech infrastructure, they've just have this like hand wavy approach saying, oh, we can just throw machines at this. And that I always cringe at that because yeah, 2008, okay, that worked, but in 2023, like you're throwing money away. And I guess if you're ideologically not interested in Elixir or a language that's going to make better, I'd say system resource usage, okay. But I've never really bought into that perspective of I'm on this CTO Slack, and I mean this is a constant thing that comes up is some of the more, I'd say, seasoned CTOs, they will die on that hill, you know. And maybe that worked for them, getting their startup past that point, getting to IPO. Yeah, just throwing hardware at the problem worked for them. But I don't think we live in the same time anymore when that really is a responsible direction for companies to take.
I absolutely agree. I think that you know, another facet to that, or another aspect to it as well, which is that once you're kind of on a path, and as things grow and outgrow the resources that you're giving it, it's much easier to throw hardware at the problem, right? It's much
Sure.
easier to say, all right, we've got a 32 machine cluster, we'll do a 40 machine cluster now, and we'll just keep growing it. That's so much easier than spending the engineering time. And when you're resource when you're engineering constrained, when you're human resource constrained, that seems like the obvious answer. And it's it is pernicious, and it's like there's very much a frog in boiling water situation that happens
Yeah,
there.
I think too it's an education aspect because it's funny, like Elixir, I think, has grown this reputation to being like Hacker News's favorite language. Like there's always whenever Elixir comes up as a Hacker News link, the comments are always very positive about it, which is, kind of a rarity on Hacker News. It's a very cynical crowd. Yet its adoption rate doesn't reflect the enthusiasm that I see amongst these fairly educated tech groups. And so, like, my take on it is I think most people in that decision-making position either are dubious of the performance benefits and outcomes that could come across from adopting Elixir, or they just tend to think, oh, it's just another language. It has some of the same, they all kind of roughly work the same. And that's been a bit of, I think, like a adoptability marketing uphill battle that Elixir still is yet to climb. So going to the other myth to dispel on the like right tool for the right job. And it could be argued that maybe looks, I mean, Sasha has that famous table where it shows like Erlang being the right thing for everything. But moving over from a multi-language company to a mono-language company, was there resistance inside? What were those arguments, and how was the team transition overall? I guess we should start.
It
What's your
was a
team
bit.
size? Yeah, like how many people are we talking about?
It has shrunk. So today it's two. Well, it's
Okay.
a whole team of four. There are two developers. When I started the journey into Elixir and started all that, we had 12 developers.
And has that team size changed because you just don't need as many people now?
That's precisely it. So when I first made that decision to move to LiveView, we had actually just started building a team that was going to have some more specialized JavaScript developers. It's one of my biggest regrets, I think, as a CTO, that I brought some people in and then immediately had to ask them to go. But then over time, we still had a pretty large team. I think we had 8 or 9 people at that point. Working mostly on Elixir and then as I said, a bit of Python. Over time, you just kind of people leave, they go do their own thing, they move on to other opportunities and stuff, and we found ourselves not hiring to replace them. Every time, someone left, we thought, oh, we'll need to hire someone to replace this person. And we found that actually Elixir, the stack that we were using meant that we just don't need the person power anymore. Where things started getting, as we learned more and as we developed our stack and as we kind of happily evolved into a monolingual company and got more and more comfortable with Elixir, we found that we just didn't need that many people.
And payroll is every company's biggest overhead cost.
Absolutely. Yeah, no question about it.
In hearing you talk about the transition, so originally I'd been really curious about the transition from something like React and Phoenix with this very clear client backend boundary and separation in the team to something like LiveView, which I think I've heard some companies say, they don't know how to split up their teams when they're using LiveView. They're like, the waters are just a little bit muddy here. And it tends to encourage more full stack development, which is my personal preference anyway. But I'm curious, coming from that perspective of shrinking your team down, building things more efficiently, would you attribute that to Elixir? Or would you attribute that to unifying on a similar technology? Because I think that's also one of the objections someone might have here. So they might say, well, it's just because you're using shared language. What is the Elixir part actually doing for me?
I think that's a really good point of nuance there. I really do think It's Elixir. I certainly think a portion of it is just from unifying, circling the wagons, everyone doing the same thing. That must account for some of it, right? But and maybe this goes back to what you were saying way back, Brian, about like sometimes it's difficult to quantify some of these things and the ability to communicate until you actually try it. But going from ideation to putting a feature in front of my customers is something that I can, that I can do one of my colleagues can do in a couple of hours now. And the things that you get with OTP, the things that you get out of the box with things like PubSub for, having real-time updates on, one of your colleagues' computers when you make a change on your machine, and not having to you pull down different tools to do all these different things. I definitely think that actually using Elixir specifically is the thing. Using LiveView in particular is massive. I mean, one of the other developer that I'm working with most of the time is kind of a grumpy old man stereotype, and doesn't like doing front-end development, hates doing CSS, and even he finds it really joyful. And I think that that's, again, one of those unquantifiable aspects of this, is that when you can go and just build out a feature from zero to one in no time at all, it's fun. It's fun. And doing it in Elixir makes it fun.
Not fighting your tools to get your job done is a benefit that goes undervalued. Like the productivity gains alone, I think are always worth consideration. Like, so we have some recent success and wins with moving. We've been experimenting with changing some. We're doing this whole like internal project when it comes to like Sailboat Analytics, and we've hired a computational fluid dynamics PhD to actually build out a solver for us to measure lift and drag on sailboats. And so he's building out the 2D solver right now in MATLAB. We're trying to determine whether or not this is financially viable, because when it comes to like doing one boat, the rendering traditionally can be very lengthy. But moving it over to NX, could this be viable for us to like say, hey, now this could be like a platform as a SaaS-based service, and you can render something out in a reasonable amount of time for what the machine cost would be. Paulo did I think a like 3 or 4 hour rewrite and saw a 100x performance improvement. And that's not even tapping into a lot of other things like distribution. Like the data size was too small to really see benefits from distribution. And like these are the outcomes I think that have largely gone like unnoticed outside of the NX community so far. People are primarily looking at GPUs, and yes, absolutely, those are going to be like major performance bumps. But there's still a lot of things that can be solved in software.
Absolutely. And I think, to come back to some of the points that we had made before, about kind of the ecosystem and about the tools that we have available to us. So one thing that I often kind of brag about to friends in machine learning who are using Python is Mix. You talk about the time spent in rendering, you talk about the time spent in actually processing things, but the time spent in fighting your tools, I think you just mentioned fighting your tools a moment ago. The time spent fighting your tools, I cannot tell you how much time I spent fighting, pip and poetry and all these different build and packaging tools for Python, and trying to get them to work in a reasonable way with machine learning. And to now that we're, using NX, a very similar thing, I think, with MATLAB, actually bringing MATLAB into production is a whole different story. With NX, we've got these pluggable backends, and you don't change the code, you change just the target, and it's instantaneous. We've got tools that work for us rather than against us, and that's just invaluable.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think, one of the first things people always mention about Elixir is how mature the tooling ecosystem feels for how young the language is. And I mean, that's a huge credit to Jose to doing that right and taking the time to get it right. Because I think what one thing that I don't think he's ever really articulated this, but one principle I think that he's always stuck to is ensuring that the primitives are always pristine. And when the primitives in the language and the ecosystem are pristine, then you can build on top of that. And it, like, you see the benefits as it goes. And that's, to me at least, that seems to be Jose's whole strategy around developing Elixir.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that we benefit from it all the time. It's, you know, people talk about developer experience and things like that as such a soft thing. But when it becomes the kind of foundation of the language and a driving core value of the entire language and ecosystem, you see it in the design decisions everywhere. And it has just untold knock-on effects left, right, and center. And yeah, I think, Jose always has that in mind, and it makes just such a difference.
Okay, so wrapping up, Chris, do you have any words of wisdom of companies that are considering jumping into Elixir, and anything that you feel like could push them over the edge towards it?
Yeah, I do. I think that Sean Moriarty in his 2022 Elixir Conf talk, he talked about different classes of developer or organization that might want to adopt Elixir. He talked about, if you're an Elixir developer who already has a machine learning need, if you're an Elixir developer who doesn't have one, if you're a non-Elixir developer who has a machine learning need, all these different classes. And I think that it's worth keeping that in mind and thinking about who you are as an organization and where you're going to be able to benefit. I think that story has changed since just in that, the last year, since he had that talk. And I think that, that today, the ease with which you can implement machine learning in Elixir means that I think you should actually be on the lookout for ways that you can, use machine learning if you're an Elixir developer who doesn't necessarily have a machine learning use today. If you are a developer or an organization that's not using Elixir right now, and you think that you want to be able to move faster, you want to be able to get more done with fewer resources, you don't want to fight your build tools and your deployments and all of these different things, you don't want to be confused about mutability with data, I think Elixir provides, for 99% of organizations, you can get everything that you want to get done in a machine learning, in a machine learning context. You can get it done in Elixir. I don't think that there's anything stopping you.
And just to prove we're not Elixir fanboys here, I want to end on a negative. So I'm going to ask you, what is one thing either lacking in Elixir or NX that you would like to see?
Sure. I think, there's a couple of things. So one is, I would say that Scholar, which is your traditional machine learning side of things, so rather than the deep learning, it's still young. It's still developing very quickly, and there are plenty of algorithms and things that don't exist there. I'd say that's changing very rapidly. And some of the algorithms that are there are not as fast as, the same algorithms in scikit-learn, for example, just because, scikit-learn is focusing on a very specific kind of deployment story. And I think Scholar is focused on a much more general approach. And then I'd also say that there, if you want to work with distributed models. So distributed across computers, across nodes, as opposed to distributed across GPUs on the same node. That story is just not there yet. That kind of like parallel map, all that kind of stuff. It's not there yet. And I think it will be, but it's not ready yet. So there are certainly places and there are things that you can't quite do yet. And the last thing, let's round it up to three. The last thing is Bumblebee is amazing. Bumblebee is a library for utilizing the models in Hugging Face. So that is an incredible boon. It means that you can use all the work that other people are doing, but it doesn't support everything. There are models in Hugging Face's repository that are not supported in Bumblebee yet. you certainly can implement them. But that, you know, if you're coming into it thinking I can use everything, you might be disappointed.
Well, thank you, Chris, very much for your time. I'll give you the final word. Anything else you want to sign off on?
I will just say, join us. Come to the EEF Slack where you started the chat. Come talk about it. Come have fun. Because
that's really actually a good point. I think a lot of people look at the EEF Slack as being a bit daunting. I know some people hang out on the NX channel on the public Slack, and then I've recently learned that you can't even join the public Slack. You can't sign up for it. I don't know, there's a whole thing around that. I'm not in the Discord, but I you know, if you're not on the EE Slack, you're interested in machine learning, you should join it and join the machine learning channel. Everyone on there is super friendly, happy to help and answer questions.
Exactly. I think that that's to come back to the question way back about what was one of the things that brought me into Elixir. You know, everybody says this, but the community is incredible. It's inviting. You can talk to brilliant, brilliant people, and they're excited and they have time for you. And I would just encourage anyone who's thinking about it, is on the fence, just give it a try. You'll see how fun it is. And you know, you'll get help from some really wonderful people.
Excellent. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.